I'm John Kroll. Today is Giving Tuesday. To mark the occasion, on No Limits today we're going to talk about patterns of philanthropy and ways we can establish the habit of giving in ourselves and in our children. My guests are Dean Amir Pasek and Dr. Mark Otoni Wilhelm, both of the Lilly School of Philanthropy, and Penny Lee, Chief Fundraising Officer for the United Way of Central Indiana. Please join the conversation. Call 866-476-3881, email nolimits@wfyi.org, Facebook is No Limits WFYI, Twitter is WFYI. Now, this news. Welcome to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. Today is Giving Tuesday, so we're going to be talking about the way Americans and Hoosiers give, how that may have changed over time, and how we go about establishing the habits or the patterns of philanthropy and giving. If you want to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimitswfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or track us down on Twitter at WFYI. My guests are Dr. Amir Pasek. He is dean of the Lilly Family School of Philanthropy. I started to drop the family there. At IU, Dr. Mark Otoni Wilhelm, also of the Lilly School, and Penny Lee, Chief Fundraising Officer for United Way of Central Indiana. Welcome to all of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
It's good to have you here. So we probably ought to talk about, and I think, Amir, I'll throw this one to you first, what Giving Tuesday is, how it got started, so that we have a context for the conversation.
Sure. It was started in response to this time of year when we get all kinds of messages about the importance of consumption with Black Friday and then Cyber Monday. And a couple of folks connected to the 92nd Street Y, supported by the UN Foundation in 2012, said, it is, after all, the season of giving. Let's remind folks by creating a moment that this is an important time for giving. So they started Giving Tuesday in 2012, and it's taken off like a rocket, if you will. It's become increasingly a part of our year-end environment, a part of the fabric of what we do. We kind of know after Black Friday, small business Saturday, Cyber Monday, that we are going to remember what the season is after all and focus on giving today.
So after we finish shopping with whatever is left over.
We save the best for last,
yeah,
indeed.
Yeah. So Penny, how big is this day for a not-for-profit such as the United Way?
For us, it's a big day. It's, as Amir said, as the year is coming to a close, to have another opportunity to invite people to be a part of our fundraising this year outside of the regular cycle of fundraising. And so for us this year, it's to support the United Christmas Service, and it is a big push on the day. And it's a lot of fun for the people on the United Way team as well, to have something that, whether you're a fundraiser or not on that United Way team, to push out via your social media, to really invite your networks to join you in what you care about very much. And so it's really twofold, both from the donor standpoint as well as the team coming together and getting to share.
So, Mark, and I got to say, I've been in the not-for-profit world now for coming up on 20 years, and I think this time of year, even before Giving Tuesday, was a hugely important time for just about everyone in the not-for-profit world. I think maybe only jewelry businesses do make more of their nut during November and December than most not-for-profits. Did Giving Tuesday accelerate that, or does it merely confirm what was already happening?
So the evidence is that Giving Tuesday adds to that. So you're right to say that a substantial amount of giving in a given calendar year occurs in that last month between Thanksgiving and the end of year holidays. Some analysis of data from Giving Tuesday indicates that not only does Giving Tuesday add to that, but it's increasingly adding more to that. So the spike in Giving Tuesday is approaching the size of the spike in, say, the last day of the year, as people make those last gifts to take advantage of
the tax write-offs.
Yeah, that's right.
And all of that. So one of the things I'd like to talk about, because we hear so much about how patterns of philanthropy have changed, that each generation has its own ways of giving. Could we start with, and I'm going to stay with you on that, Mark, could we start, you know, and provide just a general overview of what we have seen, and we'll start as the beginning benchmark, say the so-called greatest generation, okay. You know, those folks, and then take us through each succeeding generation.
Yeah. So what we've done at the Lilly School is look at data from the recent days, so the 2000s, and compare that to a really good snapshot of giving that was collected in the mid-1970s. So what you're able to do with those two points in time is to compare same-aged people in the 1970s with their, if you will, same-aged replacements in the 2000s. And so here the story is a little bit complicated. What's going on is that compared to, say, the greatest generation and the silent generation, mm-hmm. The percentage of people who are giving is going down somewhat. Mm-hmm. But among those people who are engaged in giving, the average amounts they're giving are holding steady. Perhaps they're going up a little bit. But so the sort of good news and bad news, the thing to focus on and think about changing is the percentage of people who are giving that's going down.
So we see participation rates dropping.
That's right.
But not necessarily. And that sort of confounds. I know about 15 years ago, most not-for-profits really started to focus heavily on planned giving campaigns and all of that, because they were, you know, at least the early returns suggested that succeeding generations, once this one was over, just were not going to support charitable operations to the degree that their predecessors had. It sounds like some of those fears may have been exaggerated, but does it mean then, Penny, that you spend more time, because there are fewer people giving and they're giving in larger amounts, does that drive you to seek big gifts more, or has it changed the way that we have to approach philanthropy?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I really look at it in two different buckets, I guess, for lack of a better word. That development of major gifts and transformational giving is, from a United Way standpoint, not something we were really focused on mm-hmm. a number of years ago. And so really developing that program and providing more meaningful opportunities for transformational giving and more focused on cultivating those deeper relationships has become key for us. At the same time, the pipeline and the breadth of younger donors, I think one of the biggest challenges that we face right now and incredible opportunity is how to engage more and more folks who are in that declining demographic in terms of numbers to feel their importance in philanthropy, as well as getting engaged in issues that are out in the community, and finding ways for them to balance that and start that, getting that muscle of actually giving is one of our biggest challenges. And so we see it as two big buckets that we have to pay attention to at the same time.
We are talking about Giving Tuesday and patterns of philanthropy here on No Limits today. If you want to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, or track us down on Twitter at WFYI. So, Amir, Mark did a great job of sort of putting it in a numbers context, but this also, there's some evidence that that the approach to philanthropy is different from generation, the mindset that the person approaches it with. Could you walk us through some of the generational differences in the way that that people approach giving?
Sure, absolutely. I think there are marked differences in some of the behaviors that we see in terms of the baby boomer generation was very focused in part in terms of giving back to their community organizations and to the organizations that their lives have been a part of. And increasingly with newer generations, and this might be actually bleeding into older generation as it becomes more part of the environment, is the focus on impact in terms of figuring out what is the difference that my donation is going to make. To oversimplify somewhat, you can see people adopting more of an investment mindset, transitioning from giving back to well-established, well-known organizations to thinking about, well, what is my dollar going to accomplish for my community or for the cause that I really care about? And that has been kind of a very important underlying trend in terms of what we're trying to capture as we go forward. Another way is the way people are responding to attempts to build relationships with them. So, for example, one of the typical ways people would be solicited in earlier generations would be through mass mail. And that's where Giving mm-hmm. Tuesday is so important, because it is an attempt to reach the new generation in new ways that is not going to respond to a piece of mass mailing with labels in it in the same way that their parents and their grandparents did. They are really flocking to social media, and there's a whole ferment of innovation of trying to figure out how do you engage people in this new technology, which has become global, and Giving Tuesday is a global phenomenon. How do you use social media in innovative ways to create communities, to engage people, to make that difference? And that's where we're seeing some of the silver lining in terms of the decline in participation mm-hmm. rates. There's all this stuff going on with the new generation that is not sometimes seen as classical philanthropy, but it reflects a desire to do good and to change one's society for the better. And we're innovating and trying to keep up with the new generations and seeing what wonderful things they're going to create with this new technology.
I want to pick up on that point of how these younger generations focus on impact and think of it almost in a return on investment, and how that has shaped, you know, I'm thinking of you know, something that's going on here in the public broadcasting world called Newsmatch right now, where foundations have provided, said they're going to match gifts up to $1,000 so that you immediately know that your gift is doubled if you support it. Penny, I want to throw that to you, because that's a kind of approach. Obviously, matching gifts have been around for a long time, but generally the matches at least used to kick in only when you hit a certain dollar level or whatever. How has this changed environment forced people who are fundraising to be more creative in their approaches?
Oh, it has created the need for people to change that approach. And I think having utilizing and optimizing a digital platform mm-hmm. is something that we are not accustomed to doing. And calling to action through those digital platforms is definitely something that we are trying to get better at, because, as Amir said, the desire to truly have impact in the community cannot just be shown to them through just data and just documents and just stories. What we're finding is there needs to be a call to action, a way for people to actually get engaged and making that difference. And balancing that with our need for the fundraising is very, very challenging. And so we've had to change a lot of how we do things. And with all of the different generations come different approaches. And it used to be where you could kind of have a singular approach and some very typical ways of doing fundraising, that I think part of the excitement of having fundraisers from all different mm-hmm. generations is the excitement of them creating new ways and being a part of the solutions of how we really reach new audiences to be part of our work.
That's something we're coming up on a break, but I want to talk about a little more when we get to the other side is it sounds like donors want to have a much more personal connection with the causes they support. And I want to explore what the sources of that are and how not-for-profits can respond to that. Today is Giving Tuesday. We are talking about patterns of philanthropy and how to inculcate habits of giving and charitable giving on No Limits today. My guests are Dr. Amir Pasek. He is Dean of the Lilly Family School of Philanthropy at IU. Dr. Mark Ottoni Wilhelm, also the Lilly School, and Penny Lee, Chief Fundraising Officer for United Way of Central Indiana. If you want to join the conversation, give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. Send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org or find us on social media. I'm John Kroll. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, Director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. Today is Giving Tuesday. We're talking about philanthropy. We're talking about patterns of charitable giving and how we can develop the habit of charitable giving. My guests are Dr. Amir Pasek. He is Dean of the Lilly Family School of Philanthropy at IU. Dr. Mark Ottoni Wilhelm, also of the Lilly School. And Penny Lee, who is Chief Fundraising Officer for United Way of Central Indiana. If you want to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org, find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, or track us down on Twitter at wfyi. So, Mark, before we went to the break, I said that some of the evidence seems to suggest that the donors want different kinds of relationships with the philanthropic causes that they support. Do we know why this is, and at what point that began to occur?
So analysis we've done at the Lilly School indicates that if you look over a wide time period, mm-hmm. so say an 8-year period instead of just a 1-year period, 87% of American families give something to a charitable organization. But when you drill down a little deeper, what you see is that the frequency with which families give really varies. So you could maybe have a 3-piece pie. 50% of American families give on a regular, frequent mm-hmm. basis. About 20% give sort of time to time. And the remaining 30% sort of seldom. So the question is, to reframe your question, how can relationships be built among the people who are giving time to time to turn them into frequent givers? And likewise, people who give once in a while, how can you build relationships to turn them into time to time givers and sort of move them up the scale, so to speak? Giving Tuesday is a really good opportunity for that, because Giving Tuesday reaches to people who are not being connected with in the more traditional ways and can start that, be the platform from which that relationship building process can start.
I'm here. And does this create, though, stresses for not-for-profits? I mean, I'm thinking of, and I realize I'm likely to irritate someone with this, not necessarily in this room, but there's a reason we call the show No Limits. I'm thinking of the model of having people come and help work the food lines on Thanksgiving Day, where, at one point that grew to such a degree that literally you'd have lines of people standing in there to put one piece of turkey and a little bit of mashed potatoes in one plate, and then they were shuffled out so that, the challenges of just managing the crowd of volunteers who wanted to help were greater than actually trying to deal with the needs of the people who needed the help. Does that role, these changing expectations of how one should be involved in the causes that she or he cares about, put pressures on the causes themselves and the people who run them?
Oh, definitely. And I think Penny can speak to kind of the on-the-ground experience that she's had with the United Way, which is such an important part of our community. But there are important stresses, and I think that speaks to the increasing sophistication of our nonprofit world. It's become a complex system, and as we started to speak about the different generations and that one size no longer fits all, their nonprofits have to respond more like businesses. They have to start segmenting their donor population and try to be more sophisticated about what kinds of appeals are going to apply to different ones. And for donors themselves, as you mentioned with the Thanksgiving line, we saw many of similar situations with the recent hurricanes and disasters that we had, and people getting very excited about bringing together canned foods and sending all kinds of goods that people would need in disasters, when actually the logistical problem of gathering all these items together creates an additional stress on our whole logistical system. And the best way to actually contribute is to send whatever money you can, because that's very efficient, fungible. People on the ground can use that to really help the people on the ground. So there is, as the business side is becoming more sophisticated, requiring more analysis and research, on the individual side, I think there's a sense that, you know, it just showing up at your local shelter at Thanksgiving may not be the most rewarding for you or the most impactful way for you to engage in philanthropy. And so there is a deepening both on the donor volunteer side of thinking about, well, what am I exactly trying to do here, and taking it seriously as a part of who you really are, and not something you get to when all the serious business of life is taken care of, but seeing this as an important part of your identity. And so I think there's an increasing depth and appreciation of the thought processes that need to go both from the individual volunteer donor's perspective. You know, what does philanthropy mean to me? How can I make a serious impact? And then correspondingly on the nonprofits, the business of being a nonprofit is becoming more complex at the same time.
Penny, I think Amir gave you a cue a couple of minutes ago.
I think he did. Well placed. Actually, it's engaging donors in the work is something that becoming more creative has become really important. There's the boots on the ground that you were describing, where you go and you help on the food line. And that can be, managing volunteers can be very challenging for organizations that are trying to really meet the needs of folks. Those items and those jobs are very critical to have done, though, as well. And so providing other opportunities in ways to learn about the needs in the community through immersive learning opportunities, where people can bring their families and learn about what the concerns are in the community and do that together, is really important. Skills-based volunteering are new ways that people can really bring either their expertise through their work or their expertise through hobbies and things that they really understand, where they can come in and, rather than do something that's kind of a one-and-done, feel-good kind of volunteering, can really find ways to impact the bottom line and the business of the nonprofits. It takes a little bit more time to make those matches, but the meaning for both the organization and the individual can be incredible. And then there's also ways to get involved through advocacy to make some real change in a bigger picture, is something that I know we at United Way have been really working on, is how do we help people bring people's voices together and create a community to make bigger change rather than one at a time.
We are talking about philanthropy in honor of Giving Tuesday today on No Limits. If you want to join the conversation, you can give us a call at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI, or you can track us down on Twitter at WFYI. So what I'm hearing here is that in addition to not-for-profits and other charitable organizations having to adapt to their constituencies much more and the needs of those constituencies, the flip side of that is sometimes those constituencies want to participate in ways that may not be the most effective, which then takes us in another direction, which is it leaves organizations with a challenge of educating their constituencies I've picked on other people first in the past, Penny, so I'm going to you.
I thought it was my turn. I'll take my turn.
All right.
Actually, I think it's very important that nonprofits are very clear on what their goals are and they can articulate exactly what that mission is. Mm-hmm. It does help when a donor or an individual has ideas as to how to meet those needs and to be able to bring in those subject matter experts that I know at United Way we're very fortunate to have subject matter experts around the work that we do to help really educate. And also having the courage as a philanthropic organization that if the desire of the donor isn't really a match for the work that we are doing, mm-hmm. to help find that match in this community, because it's that work is probably really important somewhere in the community. And of course, as a fundraising arm of a great organization, that's really tough to do. But I think critically important for the whole philanthropic landscape that we're working together and not against one another to raise the community.
So let me ask this, because, we on this subject, unless Amir or Mark, you have thoughts you want to add on it, and this is sort of a personal one. My wife and I suspect, like an awful lot of couples, along about sometime in November, we sit down at the kitchen table and we take a look at our pretty meager pot of what we can afford to give to support the causes we care about. And we divide that up and we get ready to send the checks off. One of the questions that we have is, should we be including our children in those discussions? And at what point should that participation begin? Amir, I'm going to start with you first on that one.
I think that's a deeply personal choice to make, and lots of people have chosen to include their children because it's an important part of the way the family legacy is passed on, because the children learn what is important to the parents. And actually, Mark and other researchers at the school have done some very interesting, actually systematic research in terms of how generational habits do or do not get passed on through the research. But many kind of qualitatively, many families try to maintain their the continuity of some values and memories, specifically through philanthropy. So it can be quite a meaningful, but also a very frustrating for some families where they find that subsequent generations do not end up sharing the same values that they do. So maybe you Mark can.
Okay, Mark, I think now he's delivered the cue to you.
Yeah, okay. So families can do a lot to raise their children to be charitable. So a study we did indicated that the practice of talking to your children about charitable giving has a causal effect on whether or not they, in adolescence, give to a charity or to a religious congregation. Surprisingly enough, role modeling does not have that causal effect, at least as it's being played out in the family. What's surprising about that is if you do experiments, and there were a lot of these done in the 1970s and 80s by developmental psychologists, role modeling, you can get kids to give by showing them a role model. So what do we think is going on is that to take the example you gave where the parents are at the kitchen table doing the giving, the kids aren't even aware of that. And so one answer to your question is to make sure your children know what you're doing and explain to them why you're doing it. And then at the same time, give them some control over resources of their own. Most kids might get an allowance or money for chores, allow them and encourage them to make their own decisions about charitable giving, even at a young age.
Penny, how do you go about reaching out to multiple generations? I mean, this is one of those things I think that obviously if your last name is Gates or Rockefeller or something like, there's an understanding that philanthropy is going to be sort of part of the, and they're educated in that. For most of us, though, philanthropy occurs at much lower levels and all of that. How do you handle having the conversations with, with multiple generations of the same family.
Well, first of all, thank you for doing that, John, because the more people who do that, the better this generational change will happen, and taking the time to care about your family and how they see their role in giving back to the community. I think that it's different conversations with different people. There are some families who have the financial ability to give more, and oftentimes involving the family in those conversations is part of the expectation of the family members, so that they are sure that they're all thinking the same way. But I think about my own experiences with my children, who are grown now and they're millennials, and so they're in that group of where we're wondering what their philanthropic life is going to look like, and just modeling that and being very intentional about it and continuing to encourage people, again, through family philanthropy and providing opportunities for families to give back together, creates the opportunity for that conversation. But I do think it's terribly personal. It's very personal into how that works. But anything that we can be doing from this field to encourage those conversations and continuing the practice of giving back and being a part of the impact is critical.
We are talking about Giving Tuesday and philanthropic practices here on No Limits. If you want to join the conversation, you could send us an email at nolimitswfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI. You can track us down on Twitter at WFYI, or you can do what Judith has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Judith, you're on the air.
Thank you.
I have
another issue with philanthropy, and I don't think it's been discussed. I just turned on the radio a few minutes ago, so I don't know. But I came back from a Thanksgiving and found a 3-inch pile of requests for money, and most of them included free gift inside. Now, last year, I decided that I was going to count the free gifts. I had 31 wall calendars, more than 3,500 address labels, 52 notebooks or note cards, and then a plethora of other types of things. And when I was a child, I was taught that you gave freely as you were able, and you didn't expect anything to come back. And I'm wondering how that whole philosophy of giving has gotten lost. And I had a box that was about 12 by 12 by 5. It was full by October 1st.
Okay, well, let me see if I can get a response on that. Thanks very much for the call, Judith.
Okay, I don't want to sound like a crab, but
no, well, actually, that's an issue my father has, too.
Good. Thanks.
Yeah. I think that Judith encapsulates a lot of what we've been talking about, the generational changes, the importance of the business, because I think if she counted the amount of commercial products that she had received in the mail, she would have also been astounded as well. The nonprofits are really trying to compete and looking at the evidence that those mailings with gifts inside do, on the margin, still succeed for them. They do as well. But she also brings up an important philosophical notion that has been around with us for some time, the faith-based notion that the anonymous giving is the most elevated form of giving, and that's still with us as well. So it is, we have different traditions of philanthropy coming together, both the philosophical deep meaning of giving freely and of yourself, but also on the business side, the solicitation, and the research shows is the one thing that really helps make the difference is the ask.
We are talking about philanthropy in honor of Giving Tuesday, which is today. My guests are Dr. Amir Pasek. He is Dean of the Lilly Family School of Philanthropy at IU. Dr. Mark Ottoni Wilhelm, also the Lilly School, and Penny Lee, Chief Fundraising Officer for United Way of Central Indiana. If you want to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. Send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at NoLimitsWFYI or track us down on Twitter at WFYI. I'm John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. We're talking today about philanthropy, about habits of charitable giving in honor of Giving Tuesday. If you want to join the conversation, you can give us a call at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimitswfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or track us down on Twitter at WFYI. My guests are Dr. Amir Pasek. He is dean of the Lilly Family School of Philanthropy at IU. Dr. Mark Ottoni Wilhelm, also the Lilly School, and Penny Lee, who is Chief Fundraising Officer for United Way of Central Indiana. Got a question from a listener named Cheryl who did not want to go on the air. Cheryl writes, "There are some charities my parents gave to all my life, but now I see information, or maybe misinformation, about how some of these well-known groups use the money. Does it go to administration? Does it go to research or people who need assistance? People share graphics on social media like they're truth, but how do I really find out?" Mark, I think that one's got your name written all over it.
Yeah. I think the thing to do is to pick one organization whose mission resonates with you and look into how that organization operates and see if you can align yourself with what it's doing. At the same time, any organization is going to require some amount of administration, and in the nonprofit sector, because donations are what drives it, there's going to be fundraising expenses. And when we buy other products, like we buy a car, we don't say, "Hey, wait a minute, GM used a portion of that funds, maybe 10% or 20% for administration and finance." But it's an important part of delivering the whole. So also go into the exercise that way, realizing that it's going to take some amount of administration and fundraising to enable the impact to be made.
Penny, that's got to be kind of a frustrating question or discussion to have, because I'll say in full disclosure to the audience, I try not to hold anything back, because I have done fundraising in my time as well. I remember having this conversation at times with donors, and they'd say, "Well, how much of this goes to pay salaries or whatever the organization?" And I'd say, "Well, yeah, fair bit, because reality is if we don't pay at least livable wages, the only people who would be able to do this would have the benefit of independent means or trust funds or something like that. The people who want to do this work also have to get paid for it."
And I think that is an excellent point. And also, when I know at United Way in our impact work, we have, as I said before, subject matter experts, individuals who are really strong in each of the fields that they have. And it's important that those folks are a part of something that allows their life to be lived as well, to where that they can have that income. And also spending our money in places where we're sure that the impact is going to be the most critical. I think it's our responsibility to be as efficient and as smart with our money as we possibly can, and to consider and to continue to be very transparent about what our overhead rate is and how much we actually spend. And I know we work very hard to keep that overhead rate at about 13%, but these social media posts and things that Cheryl is talking about are very real, and they come across as reality rather than necessarily fact. They aren't. Some of them have facts in them, and some of them do not. But I think taking the time, like Mark said, if there's an organization that you are committed to take the time to ask the questions, to understand how they are using the funds, and understand that it is running a business. And so mm-hmm. a nonprofit does not mean that you don't run on any funding at all. It's critically important that we're able to do the quality work that can have the impact in the community.
Yeah, my guess is that you don't get, you know, the lights don't come on all by themselves right. or anything like
it's
that.
It's not magic. I mean, yeah.
And just to Cheryl's point, if you have some doubts, if there's been some changes in the organization, there are established trusted places like GuideStar.org or Give.org that's run by the Better Business Bureau where you can see to make sure that the charity in question has filed their tax returns, and usually you can see actually the ratios that they do devote to administration and fundraising as well. But to John's point, the nonprofit sector, which is about 10% of our economy, does some of the most important things in our society, from health to social services to the creative arts, that you really want to be able to support talent, which is often categorized as overhead, which is a big mistake often. So try to learn as much as you can about the organization. And because we so rarely cover the nonprofit sector and philanthropy in the media, which is so wonderful that we're here today, people often learn through scandals or things going wrong about what's going on in the nonprofit sector, rather than having many positive stories, which I'm so happy that we at least have that opportunity through this show and Giving Tuesday more broadly to talk about.
We've alluded to this, but I want to talk also about how the explosion in technology has changed the way people participate in philanthropy. I mean, an example would be the Give-O-Meter, for example. Amir, can you walk us through that?
Sure. This is a research project that our school did, is to look at the data that we have been compiling through a large research project that looks at 10,000 households over time and their behaviors. And what you can do on the Giving for Life website that has the Give-O-Meter is you can go on this website and plug in your demographic background or your location and see how people around you give, how much they give, what kind of things they give to, and also people from your particular background, your gender, your age, how they give. So it's kind of a graphical opportunity for you to see where you fit in the American landscape of giving. And you can rank different areas based on that. So it's Generosity for Life is the name of the website.
Oh, so that's the URL,
yeah.
generosityforlife.org?
Correct.
.org, I presume. And all you have to do is plug that in. So let's talk, Penny, about how the model has changed. United Way is obviously one of the larger philanthropic mm-hmm. organizations around.
Mm-hmm.
How, you know, having to deal with the realities of online giving and all of that have changed the way that an organization such as United Way has to go about its work?
Mm-hmm. Well, United Way, a major portion of our fundraising model is through workplace giving, mm-hmm. and that is a critical space and very privileged space that United Way has been in for quite some time. And that model has shifted. Well, that model includes payroll deduction. And so having that workplace opportunity to go in and to reach out to folks used to be the type of thing that we would come in, we would do the fundraising. This was an easy way for people to give. And so they did it because it was easy. They trusted the organization, didn't really need to know anything more than that, and go back about their business until the next year. And that's not the landscape of philanthropy anymore. It's about creating relationships with large numbers of people in a way that one-on-one is not really possible because there are so many of those. We have about 50,000 donors here in central Indiana, and communicating in a digital way that is impactful, talks about stories, and engages people and makes them think about their own philanthropy and their own role in philanthropy is critically important. I think with some of our, we used to have groups and communities that we would create around donor giving levels, where now the importance is more around issues and people being able to come and create communities with larger numbers of people that maybe isn't around the amount that they give, so much as what they're interested in and where they want to make an impact. And so those are things that are all on our radar with keeping some of the traditional pieces. Again, the workplace model, while we need to adapt that and grow that and deepen that, still does create quite an opportunity for us when it comes to fundraising annually.
We've gotten an email from our regular listener, Sean, and it's fairly lengthy. It's multiple points, but it's thoughtful. So I'm gonna go through all of it. And again, if others want to join the conversation via email, you can find us at nolimits@wfyi.org. Sean writes, as great as the idea is, I have a few concerns. One, have a whole week. A giving day is like a 0.00008% tax increase to build more correctional facility and calling it an infrastructure project. A day isn't long, especially in our ever-busy world. Two, make it the beginning of the month when us receiving government assistance have the funds to contribute. Every bit counts. Three, have this be at a time of the year when most of the people nowadays don't think about it being the giving time of year. It heightens the awareness of need and gives people who normally don't take the time to appreciate what they have. Four, to many people I've talked with, this is just another thing to worry about and while having to be aware of expenses. Throughout the years, I have observed that this is just another giving event at a time when there is a plethora of them. What separates this from all the others? Us year-round do-gooders get frustrated by this being the only time of year when people really give, and then around January 20th, it all stops. Come on, people, make every day a giving day. Okay, Penny, I'll let you take the first crack at that one.
Well, Sean, I think if every day was a giving day, I couldn't agree with you more.
And your job would be a lot easier.
My job would be a lot easier, absolutely. So, Sean, I'm right there with you. I think when you think about this actual day that exists of this Giving Tuesday, it's, as Amir explained, kind of how it came into existence, it's also just a piece of an entire journey that I know our donors can mm-hmm. have with us. And what I think is very important is a variety of ways for people to get involved throughout the calendar year, both through giving and through getting engaged in some way, that this is one more platform that many people do respond very positively to, and it feels like the right time. This is where I think understanding each of our donors, including Sean, and what motivates people and what their circumstances are, is why it's critically important that we aren't just fundraising at one time of the year. While a lot of fundraising happens at the end of the year because of different tax reasons, and that's just the cycle that people are on, creating opportunities throughout the year is very important so that people with different situations and motivations have that opportunity. And so, Sean, I agree with you. I think there is great merit to Giving Tuesday as another way to elevate giving. But I think it's important to us as the fundraising world to keep that as part of a much larger picture in the way they can engage.
I want to talk about, we've got just a few minutes left here. Another component, though, to all of this, to the fundraising. I remember when I was leading a not-for-profit, around the time that Ruth Lilly actually made the huge gift to the Tiny Little Poetry Foundation, which up until that gift landed, I think pretty much struggled to pay the light bill and put stamps on envelopes and all of that sort of stuff, and suddenly was transformed. And the board that I served said, oh, wow, wouldn't it be great if something like that happened to us? And they said, we'd never have to go out and fundraise again. To which I said, well, I hope that doesn't happen, because if nothing else, having to go out and ask for support pushes us, prods us to have the kinds of conversations with the people who care about the cause that otherwise might get overlooked. Is there an element to this? Mark, you're making eye contact with me, so I'm going to go with you.
Yeah, I'm just remembering back to the days when Ruth Lilly made that gift, and that was just a wonderful thing.
Well, that was a transformational thing, but it also threw the Poetry Foundation for a loop in a big way.
Yeah. So what was the question?
Well, my question is, is there a part of the fact that most not-for-profits do have to solicit support, forces them to have conversations that otherwise might not occur?
That's right. What nonprofits are doing is they're facing sort of two sides of a market, if you will. And the one side of the market are the donors, and the other side are the services that are generated, the art that's created, the healthcare that's delivered, as Amir was saying. And so being in that marketplace, so to speak, with the donors is important to learn what people want to see happen. Penny's talked a little bit about that. At the same time, being in the marketplace of the output of the charities is important also to see what the needs are from the perspective of the services being provided.
Penny, when I was raising the question, not to put you on, your head was bobbing up and down like a sewing needle.
It tends to do that.
Yeah. So obviously that sort of spoke to you. Do you enjoy having those kinds of conversations with people?
Absolutely. I think being a fundraiser is actually a real privilege to be able to share about the work of the organization that you're representing. And it also keeps the organization on its toes. I think the big point that you were leading towards is we cannot become irrelevant. We cannot become stagnant in the work that we're doing. Any time that you just sit back and rest on your laurels is a very risky time that you're not being what the community really needs you to be. And by continuing to tell our story and refine our story also causes us to continue to refine the work and the focus and the efforts that we put in.
So we've got just a little bit of time left. I want to go around the horn, give each of you maybe 30 seconds, maybe 20 seconds, actually. Amir, I'm going to start with you. What is one way that people who are thinking about giving today could make their giving more effective?
I would, just following the theme that you brought up about the power of fundraising, is ask somebody else to join you, I think. Ask your family, ask your neighbor, ask somebody else to participate with you. That will give more meaning to you, and realize that as Penny was saying and Mark was saying as well, there's a vitality to asking. It's not only about the glory of giving, which is wonderful, but there's the power in asking others to join you that will improve your giving and your experience in it.
Mark, you got 20 seconds. What's one way?
Find a way to do some of the things that Sean was suggesting, which were to make a Giving Tuesday pattern throughout the rest of the year. Pick a first day of the month and give and share that with someone, especially your kids.
Penny, you get the last word.
I get the last word. Mm-hmm. Well, I think it's giving is a real privilege, and I definitely share Amir's idea of inviting people to join you. Fundraising is actually a very rewarding role and a great way to live your life, to invite more people to make an impact in the community.
That is the last word. I'd like to thank my guests, Amir Pasek, Mark Otoni Wilhelm, and Penny Lee, for this incredibly charitable conversation. I am John Kroll. You've been listening to No Limits. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Producer, Shannon Cagle. Interactive Media Coordinator, Scott McAllister. Technical Producers, Cedric Freeman and Chris Flood. And Board Engineer, Joe Hatcher. No Limits is made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.